Tax Update Podcast for June 22nd, 2007. This is a Tax Update Podcast for June 22nd, 2007. This week, testing the limits. What is an understatement of gross income? The Tax Update Podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research and confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. Podcast and this document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the audio podcast. Such prohibited use include using the podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. This podcast is sponsored by Lineberg Information Services located on the web at www.linebergservices.com. Lineberg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful information tax practitioners to subscribe to their services. Again, you can visit them on the web at www.linebergservices.com. This week, we're going to take a look at an IRS loss on a case about the extended statute of limitations. We have to deal with the measurement of the inclusion or failure to include an item of gross income in a return. The IRS had recently won two cases dealing with a different issue related to statute of limitation matters with basically two paired sections where there was a question where the two statutes didn't have the same time period. Did the IRS have to meet both or was only one involved? And that was a case of G5 Investment Partnerships 128 TC number 15 and Klingfeld Holdings 128 TC number 16. The IRS won in that particular case, a position they wanted to argue for the opening of the statute. But coming up next, the tax court now being on a roll and issuing its third straight reported decision on statute matters, the IRS was not so lucky in the case of Bakersfield Energy Partners 128 TC number 17, which is the case we're going to look at this week. In this case, the question revolved around what constituted an omission of gross income that triggered an extended six-year statute of limitations under Section 6629 C2, and similarly would have triggered it under Section 6501 E1A. Now, the key question they were looking at in this case was the question that if you had overstated basis on a piece of property that was used in computing a Section 1231 gain, in this case on a partnership return, did that reduced reported 1231 gain, was that when that was adjusted upward, did that count toward the 25%, or, as the taxpayer argued, was the gross income measurement truly based upon the reported sales price, which in this case did not change because the only matter at issue was the question of the basis of the property sold? Now, the tax court ultimately agreed with the taxpayer, and we'll go through some of the reasons as to why this was true. But the key issue the tax court looked at was the applicability of a 1958 U.S. Supreme Court decision in the case of Colony Inc. versus Commissioner. And using the logic of that decision, arrived at the same conclusion under the current code as was true there under the 1939 code. Now let's take a look at the underlying basic law. The general rule for assessing tax against an individual is found in Section 6501A, which provides, except as otherwise provided in the section, the amount of any tax imposed by this title shall be assessed within 3 years after the return is filed, whether or not such return was filed on or after the date prescribed, or if the tax is payable by stamp any time after the tax came due and before the expiration of 3 years after the date on which part was taxed was paid, and no proceeding in court without assessment for collection of such tax shall be begun after the expiration of such periods. Now, the general three-year statute can be extended if the taxpayer runs afoul of Section 6501 E1 Cap A, in which case there is a six-year statute. And that provides for substantial omission of items that basically, if a taxpayer omits from gross income an amount properly includable therein, which is excess of 25% of the amount of gross income stated in the return, the tax may be assessed or a proceeding in court for collection of such tax may be begun without assessment at any time within 6 years after the return was filed. Now, it goes on to state, for purposes of this subparagraph, in the case of a trade or business, the term gross incomes means the total of amounts received or accrued from the sales of goods or services, if such amounts are required to be shown on the return, prior to the diminution by the cost of such sales and services, and to Determining the amount minted from gross income, there shall not be taken into account any amount which is omitted from gross income stated in the return, if such amount is disclosed in the return or in a statement attached to the return in a manner adequate to apprise the secretary of the nature and amount of such item. Now, the key issue we're going to look at here is, in this case, technically falls under the assessment on partnerships for 6229. Which provides a similar set of rules. The general rule at 6629A provides a 3-year period from the later of the date by which the partnership return was filed to the last day for filing a return for such year, determined without regard for an extension. There is a general 3-year period during which the IRS can assess for a partnership item. And again, that statute is extended to 6 years if there is an omission that triggers 6229C2, which reads very similarly. If any partnership omits from gross income an amount properly includable therein, which is in excess of 25% of the amount of gross income stated in its return, then subsection A should be applied by substituting 6 years for 3 years. Now, as the court points out, 6229 doesn't really duplicate all the provisions of 6501, but the court notes that generally the case law has followed that 6501 principles have been used in interpreting what Congress meant in 6229. So for practical purposes, we're going to analyze this particular issue that we're going to discuss based upon the same result for 6501 as the 6229. And so the question becomes, does this reporting of a lower 1231 gain, in this case going to be a very substantially lower 1231 gain, due to a disagreement over the basis, in this case the IRS position is going to be the basis was zero, the taxpayer's position is the basis was substantially more than zero, does that, in fact, allow us a 6-year statute during which we can litigate the dispute? Or, as the taxpayer concludes, is this an issue the IRS has now raised too late because they are not attacking the gross income or the sales price reported? Now, if you take a look at the facts, we've got those reproduced in the materials. And again, like always, the materials are available through a link on my Libsyn website, or on a link on the Limeburg website for this particular podcast, as well as being noted in the show notes if you're reading this on an iPod or other MP3 player that shows you the show notes. And on that, we had a partnership that had basically the following types. It had ordinary income or loss from other partnerships reported on the front of its return of $273,262. And a net gain or a net gain from $47.97 to $1,993,034. For basically a total income of $2,266,296. Now, on examination, the IRS adjusted that 1231 gain, reported as a net gain from Form 4797, by denying the entire basis claimed against the sales proceeds, claiming that the transaction that supposedly established the basis under Section 743B was a sham transaction. The total amount of disallowed basis was $16,515,194. Fairly substantial sum, and obviously well in excess of the 25%, if in fact our measuring number is going to be the numbers reported up there. If this is going to count in the IRS theory, we're way over the top on 25%. But the key question becomes, was that truly the issue? The IRS, in making their adjustment on the 1231 gain, kept the same gross sales price that had been reported on the original return. There was no allegation the sales price wasn't reported correctly. The allegation was the basis was overstated, which caused the net 1240 net gain on 4797 to be overstated, causing essentially the total income reported for the partnership to be understated by these numbers. Now, the IRS issued their notice more than 3 years after the 3 year period has expired. So we're into between the 3 and the 6 year period. The IRS claim is that the taxpayer had admitted from reported total income on the return an amount that was far more than 25% of such total income by essentially having reported a significantly too large amount as basis. The IRS will claim, therefore, that for 1231 gains, the proper amount to use in computing gross income is the net gain under 1231, in which case this overstatement of basis would cause the net gain to swell dramatically and be well in excess of the 25%. Now, the taxpayer obviously disagreed. From the taxpayer's viewpoint, the amount of gross income is the sales price reported before reduction for the basis. And the total sales price was properly reported on the return, and this is fundamentally different from a case where the income was omitted or understated dramatically. In essence, in that case, the IRS would be sent on a hide-and-seek game to find the missing income. Here, they were apprised of the fact that there was a sale for a significant amount, and therefore there's no unfairness inherent in holding the IRS to the three-year statute. Now, the question before the court is whether to grant the partnership's request for summary judgment. Judge Cohen notes that if the period of limitation is open with respect to any part in a partnership, adjustments made in the FPAA and issue would have to be examined on the merits. However, the parties have stipulated that they know of no other exception to the normal three-year period with respect to the individual partners, and the IRS has conceded that if the court determines the petitioner's failure to include net gain from sale of property does not constitute an omission from gross income for this purpose, that the court should grant the partnership's motion for summary judgment and essentially get rid of this case. So the question boils down to this. Is there any point in going further in the analysis of this case, or is the IRS simply too late and it's irrelevant? Now, the court goes on to note that the parties have also agreed the same principles involved should apply in applying Section 6229 as doing 6501 for the six-year statute. Judge Cohen also notes the IRS is arguing the interpretation of a similar statute by the United States Supreme Court in Colony versus Commissioner under the 1939 Code should not be used to interpret provisions under the 86 Code. The IRS is particularly interested in the language found in Section 6501E1A little I, which provides the following special definition that in the case of a trade or business, the term gross income means the amounts received or accrued from the sale of goods or services, if such amounts are required shown on the return, prior diminution by the cost of such sales and services. In the IRS viewpoint, this language in the code is a special case. It tells us that while generally we would have counted the net amount, Congress carved out a special exception that if you're in trade or business of selling goods and services, then you get to use the gross number. But absent that case, which was not the case here, they were not selling inventory, that Congress meant that you use the net number, and that's the proper way to interpret the code. Now, in Colony, Inc., the Supreme Court held an entity in the business of selling land that had overstated basis but properly valued the sale before the sales price did not run afoul of the predecessor of 6501 under 39 Code, which then was Section 275C. The tax court quoted the following provisions from the Supreme Court's opinion. In determining the correct interpretation of Section 275, the tax court notes this is now Section 6501E, we start with the critical statutory language omits from gross income an amount properly includable therein. The commissioner states the draftsman's use of the word amount instead of, for example, item suggests a concentration on the quantitative aspects of the error. That is, whether or not gross income was understated by as much as 25%. This view is somewhat reinforced if, in reading the above quoted phrase, one touches lightly on the word omits and bears down hard on the words gross income. Where a cost item is overstated, as in the case before us, gross income is affected to the same degree as when a gross receipt item of the same amount is completely omitted from the return. On the other hand, the taxpayer contends the commissioner's reading fails to take full account of the word omits, which Congress selected when it could have chosen another verb such as reduces or understate, either one of which would have pointed significantly in the commissioner's direction. The taxpayer also points out that normally statutory words are presumed to be used according to their ordinary and usual sense with the meaning commonly attributable to them. Omit is defined in Webster's New International Dictionary as to leave out or unmention, not to insert, include, or name, and the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit has elsewhere similarly defined the word. Relying on this definition, the taxpayer says the statute is limited to situations where the specific receipts or accrual of income is left out of the computation of gross income. For the reasons stated below, we agree with the taxpayer's position. The Supreme Court ultimately concluded, as cited by the tax court, we think that enacting Section 275C, which you may remember is the equivalent of our current 6501E, Congress manifested no broader purpose than to give the commissioner an additional 2 years, and now 3 under the current law, to investigate tax returns in cases where, because of taxpayer omission to report some taxable item, the commissioner is at a special disadvantage in detecting errors. In such instances, the return on its face basically provides no clue to the existence of the omitted item. On the other hand, when, as here, the understatement of a tax arises from an error in reporting an item disclosed on the face of the return, the commissioner is at no such disadvantage. Now, the key question becomes, does the fact pattern change when analyzed outside of the 39 code and analyzed with the current code? Ultimately, Judge Cohen sees no reason to arrive at a different result. She says, we are unpersuaded by respondents' whole attempt to distinguish and diminish the Supreme Court's holding Colony Inc. versus Commissioner. We do not believe either the language or rationale of Colony can be limited to the sales of goods or services by a trade or business. As petitioners point out, the Supreme Court held that omits means something left out, not something put in and overstated. Key issue here, as noted, the Supreme Court concentrated heavily in Colony on the question of the fact that it was their interpretation that Congress intended the extended statute and the fact they concentrated on omitting gross income to take care of a situation where the IRS was disadvantaged. It was not interpreted as a provision that was meant to be a punitive provision that said if your error is big enough, there's an extended period of statutes. Rather, the question was a specific type of behavior that was omission of gross income, which put the IRS at an unfair disadvantage and made it more fair to extend the statute when the IRS had to first uncover the basic existence of the income, as opposed to being fully apprised the income exists and that there was a basis issue, and therefore being fully apprised that that was a matter they could and potentially should challenge. Obviously, the IRS thought a different result was regarded based upon the fact that cost of goods sold were given a specific line item in 6501E. The tax court was not so persuaded, believing that the words still come out the same, and that wasn't, perhaps we should say, a special case so much as an example of the case, or more an explanation of the provision, that was how you properly computed these numbers. The IRS is simply out of luck in this case because nothing was left off the return, and they simply failed to act within 3 years to challenge the stated basis that was obviously an issue in computing the income. The taxpayer had disclosed the position. The IRS in this case did not argue that any other provision applied that would somehow extend this statute and make it longer. Therefore, the IRS was now stuck with not being able to assess the tax. Now, what this means in our cases? Well, obviously, it's somewhat important to know if you have a 3 or 6 year statute when you're dealing with a case in the IRS and a potential assessment down the line. It's important to note that, as I said, there were two other cases decided in a different context with assessments on partnerships where the IRS won. So apparently statutes matter, interestingly enough, appear to be an interesting litigating position today, probably because the IRS has felt that during the heyday of the marketed tax shelter that they were put at a disadvantage and now they're kind of catching up on these transactions. Note that in the case of the Bakersfield case we're discussing, the IRS claim in the case in question underlying was a sham transaction that had invented basis under 743, the very sort of partnership, use of a partnership to do some basis transactions that is at the heart of many of what the IRS felt were abusive tax shelters. Therefore, it's the very sort of thing the IRS would probably have loved to have an extended statute to go after, but the sort of thing which right now they apparently don't have such an extended statute if, in fact, the gross income itself was properly reported and there's no evidence of other underlying fraud or addition or attempt to mislead the service. So it is a case to keep your eye on and to watch. Now, as I've mentioned earlier, I am going to be speaking here in Phoenix, actually, on July the 27th, on some matters involving the various rules for tax practice, including ethics and their impact on tax practice and other matters. The Arizona Society has now announced there's going to be a location change here, and it should probably be on their website, hopefully by the time you read this, as to where our location is going to move. So apparently we will not be in the new society offices, but will be located at a slightly different location in order to take the course due to a relocation, because there are two CPE courses scheduled that day by the Arizona Society, and it appears that it has now been discovered that with the registrations they have to date, both are not going to fit in the Society offices that day, so I'm going to be on a little more on the road, a little outside. So we'll take a look, and if you want to, therefore, though, you can go ahead and sign up, and hopefully we'll see you at that course, since I presume since it's moved, there should now be some additional room available for anybody to sign up who might want to. As well, I'm going to be getting started on my other travels during the year. I'll be in Westchester, New York, basically the week after that, doing a couple of presentations up there. And then getting myself going later during the year, I'll be in Casper, Wyoming. I'll actually make even an appearance. I'll have one day in Orange County, California later this year on a partnership matter, doing a partnership course. So I'll be traveling around doing a few of these in the interim, but hopefully we'll be able to keep the podcast up to speed and keep things going. This week's podcast is a little bit early because I'm going to be taking a minor weekend vacation down near Sierra Vista in Arizona. So I'm getting this out hopefully a little bit early. So that's why you're seeing this a bit earlier than you usually see the podcast. But this has been the Tax Update Podcast for June the 22nd. The Tax Update Podcast is brought to you by Limeburg Information Services, again, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Be sure to visit there for more information of interest to tax practitioners. Note that there has been additional discussion posted there, and additional information just posted today, with a new article further outlining the 6694 penalty that we were talking about, and the changes in that, and the IRS's recent liberalization on the 6694A penalty, and what that means or doesn't mean, especially in the guise of non-income tax returns. So you might want to take a look at some of the discussion on that on the site if you're a subscriber, and if you're not, you may want to consider subscribing to Limeburg Services, again, on the web, www.limeburgservices.com. This has been the Tax Update.